Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of naturenow@kptz.org.
Hello, this is Deborah Ann Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the week of August the 14th. This week, we are pleased to have as our main topic an encore broadcast of a program that Nature Now's founder Kate Dwyer recorded with ecologist Ted Thomas of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service several years ago, which is still very timely today. Ted was speaking about butterflies and the need to preserve and restore prairie ecosystems in order to help threatened butterfly populations to recover, among other things. I thought that this would serve as a nice complement to our show on insects last week with Richard Lewis. But before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. Since last week's mystery sound was so difficult, I chose an easy one for you this week. Though you will most often hear this earlier in the year, in the late spring and early summer. Now on to Kate Dwyer's interview with Ted Thomas.
Nature Now is so pleased to have as our guest today Theodore Thomas, via phone from his Olympia office. Ted is a senior ecologist with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, where he has worked for over 20 years. His duties involve conservation of threatened plant and animal species in western Washington. Today our focus will be on the butterflies and their habitats. Welcome, Ted.
Hi, Kate. Thank you very much. I'm really honored to be here today to talk to you about conservation of some of the rarest plants and animals that we have here in western Washington and a lot of the activities that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and all of our conservation partners do on the ground to improve the conservation of these species.
Right. Well, let's get right into that. I attended your recent very interesting talk here in Port Townsend, hosted by the Washington Native Plant Society, about your work with endangered butterfly species of Washington and the many organizations, including yours, involved in this conservation effort. So let's start with how many threatened and endangered butterfly species are there in Washington?
Well, we have two different lists that we work with. We have our federal list, which actually just includes three butterflies, the Taylor's checkerspot butterfly, which is found here in western Washington on our prairies and down into the Willamette Valley of Oregon. Then we have the Fender's blue butterfly, and that's actually just found in Oregon, does not get up here into Washington State, but we consider it a western Washington grassland, western Oregon grassland species. And then the third butterfly we have is one that is found on the coast. It is the Oregon silverspot butterfly. It's found in open, dune, low grassland conditions on the Oregon and Washington coast, although it has been extirpated from Washington since 1991.
Uh-huh. And which would you say is the most threatened of those?
Well, to be honest, because we have just recently listed the Taylor's checkerspot butterfly here in 2013, and I've been working with it very closely, I would have to say that probably is our most tenuous and most in peril butterfly at this time. The other two butterflies, the Fender's blue butterfly, has been listed for about 15 years now, and it's gotten quite a bit of attention down in the Willamette Valley. It's actually improving in its status. And then the Oregon silverspot butterfly, which I mentioned is a coastal butterfly, it also is not doing very well, but I think if I had to choose of those three federally listed butterflies, I would say the Taylor's checkerspot is the one that is in the most critical condition at this time.
Right. I was fascinated during your talk here when you talked about the island marble butterfly and that it was thought to be extinct and so on. I wish you'd tell us that story.
Well, the island marble butterfly is a very interesting butterfly that was collected in 1998 by some butterfly conservationists up on San Juan Island at American Camp. And they really weren't sure what they had. And when they sent it to the experts at the Burke Museum, it came back that this was a butterfly that had not been seen since 1908, and that last observation in 1908 was up on Gabriola Island in the Gulf Islands of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So here we are, quite a distance from Gabriola Island, and 90 years later, and this butterfly is found at American camp.
That's pretty thrilling.
It was very thrilling for everybody involved in the butterfly conservation world, yes. And it was really cool to know that this species that people thought was extirpated was actually present.
Mm-hmm. Well, during your talk, you used a term, a habitat term, I'd never heard before, that I thought you could go in basking habitat in reference to butterflies.
Yeah, butterflies are organisms, or I should maybe say all insects are organisms that really, because they're cold-blooded, they need to kind of warm up their engines or warm up as the day progresses. And for butterflies, they tend to move around both as larvae and as adults to areas where it's nice and warm. So those are areas of bare ground or soil or even gravelly soil here in the gravelly outwash prairies of South Puget Sound. And this is just an area where they'll move to. They'll select moving to these areas so that they can warm themselves up basically for their daily activities.
Right. You said something about banker's hours. What was that?
Oh, well, that's just a funny term that sometimes folks who do work in butterfly, they say, oh, yeah, you know, we're kind of on the same schedule as the bankers used to be from about 10 till 5. And really, it has more to do with the days warming up. We don't tend to see butterflies moving around or flying until the temperatures generally above about 55 degrees.
And it can't be too windy either, can it?
Can't be too windy, yeah. We like to see that the winds are really less than probably 10 miles per hour. Otherwise, the butterflies just get blown off course.
Right.
And another thing to think about when we do observing of butterflies, if we can see distinct shadows, that's usually a really good time to go out and find some butterflies moving around. It's usually warm.
That's interesting. Yeah. Well, so one of these basking habitats that's important in our area are the prairies and some of the butterflies that are dependent on them. Therefore, you're also conserving prairies. So I wondered if you wanted to talk about that, the relationship between prairies and butterflies and a little bit of the history there.
Well, our prairies here in western Washington are very limited in their distribution. We have prairies that are found in South Puget Sound area that were formed by the action of the glaciers receding about 12,000 years ago. And, of course, those same glaciers, they scoured over parts of the Olympic Peninsula and most of the islands up in both San Juan County and Island County. And so you see on some of the south-facing slopes, particularly of the islands, or at the actual southern extent of the glaciers, you'll see these flat plains or very gently sloping areas that are dominated by grasslands. And they also will have many flowering plants that we call forbs, which are just low-growing either annuals or perennials, that serve as food sources both for larvae and for the adult butterflies.
Mm-hmm.
Prairies have declined, though, quite dramatically here in western Washington. It was thought that probably in the middle 1850s we might have had as much as 250,000 acres of native prairie in western Washington, native grasslands. The last time an assessment was done, it's probably more on the neighborhood of 25 to 30,000 acres. So literally just about 10% of what might have been here historically. And then the condition of what is left, there's very little of that that's really in a native condition. We usually throw around the number of about 2 or 3% of the former prairies that are now found in a native, pristine condition.
Right. So some of that is because of invasive plants, development, forests moving in. You can, you know, Himalayan blackberries overrunning it. And so, and and suppression of fire. I know you mentioned all of those things, but particularly interested in before contact with Europeans, the practices of Native Americans and in maintaining those prairies and why they maintained them.
Well, that's a really good point, Kate. We usually speak to the Native Americans prior to contact with the early European men in about 1850 here in Washington. We figure that the prairies, the grassland habitats, were being burned on a frequency of probably 3 to 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And this burning was done for a number of reasons. The burning was done to create a better forage conditions for grazing animals like deer. It also allowed them to move deer into areas where it might be more easily hunted. And burning also knocked back some of those invasive species, knocked back some of the trees that invade upon the prairies that compete with the prairie grasses and flowering plants. And by eliminating them through burning, they were keeping these areas open. And one of the other consequences that did come out of all the burning and the work that the Native Americans did on the prairie was that it improved the production of plants like camas, which was not only a food source, it was also used in trade with other tribes.
Ah, I see. Yeah, we should make it clear, too, that these are special soils. It's not just if you cut down the woods, yeah, you've got a prairie if you throw some seeds around. You had pointed out a lot of rock and when the glacial moraines or when the glacier moved from an area. And I thought you could explain more, you know, what it takes to make a prairie, a real prairie, or how they were soil-wise.
Well, if you imagine western Washington with a glacier on top of it, the ice above Olympia was estimated to be about 2,000 feet deep.
It's hard to
imagine. And that was just filled with rocks that were brought and scraped down from Canada during the whole process of the glaciers expanding. It carries all this rock material, this gravel material, and it's all being crushed up. And as the glaciers recede, they leave a very, very coarse kind of profile in the soils, which can go from sand to fine gravels to boulders to great big boulders as big as small VW.
Mm-hmm.
So, but all of those soils have a similar quality, and that is they all really drain well. In
mm-hmm.
fact, they're usually classified as excessively well-drained soils. And so we do have a whole series of different types of soils that we find on the prairie, but some of the most important ones are what we call the Nisqually soils, which is one that has considerable amount of organic material in it, and then all the gravelly, more rock-embedded soils like the Spanaway soils and the Everett soils and a whole slew of other soils that we do have.
But they have in common this great drainage there. They're not soggy, heavy clay soils.
That's correct. Yeah,
right.
The common characteristic of all these soils is that they drain really well. The
mm-hmm.
water just flows through them. So here we are in western Washington in a place that gets a lot of rain, but because the soils don't hold the water very well, it essentially drains through and to the plants that are growing on top of the soil, it is just apparently much drier than you would think, say, in a conifer forest.
Right, right. So once you have done all the political work involved in deciding on an area to, say, redevelop as a prairie or return to prairie conditions, how do you go about doing that? Say it's all covered with Scotch broom or blackberries. How do you go about establishing the new prairie and maintaining it? I know it's a big, long story, but maybe the highlights of it.
Yeah, that's a really good question, though, Kate, because a lot of the areas that we are trying to protect and conserve as prairie ecosystem, they may have become invaded by forest or they may have become invaded by Scotch broom. A lot of our native prairie lands were invaded by Scotch broom, and to be able to put that or to move that back to where it's dominated by grasses and low-growing flowering plants, we're going to have to remove all that Scotch broom. So generally, we might do that first by just mowing or brush hogging it.
Mm-hmm.
But because the seed of Scotch broom will last in the soil for decades, we have a lot of resprouting that occurs. So once we get it going and get the majority of it off, we like to go through. And as I mentioned, the Native Americans burned our prairies. Well, we want to use fire as well. So we do a lot of use of fire here in South Puget Sound. Between what is done up on what was formerly Fort Lewis, now called Joint Base Lewis-McChord, and on conserved prairie properties off of Joint Base Lewis-McChord, we're burning somewhere between 2,000 to 2,500 acres a year. And that's really our best process that we can use for knocking back the vegetation and starting out with a clean slate. But once we've removed the vegetation on top, we need to be prepared with either having plants, either as seedlings, or we have to have adequate seed to go in and occupy that land that we just cleared.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't go in and fill it with plants that we desire or we think that are the right plants for a prairie ecosystem, it will become invaded again by a whole host of invasive species, from Scotch broom to blackberry to
right.
a variety of other plants that really are not native to the prairies.
Right. Do you use some selective spraying as well of herbicides?
We do use some judicious use of herbicides, and
mm-hmm.
I say that very strongly in that it's not any of our first choice to use herbicides, but when we do a burn, we will usually get out there within a couple of weeks, because really right away after burn, we will see the worst of the invasive species. They will start to sprout and germinate, and they're quite noticeable. And the practitioners who are out there who actually do the work on the prairie, they can spot an invasive, and they'll just give it a little bit of a spray, and hopefully that will be enough to take care of it, and we'll be able to go in and either plant seedlings or plant seeds.
Right. Well, at your talk, I was quite surprised, though maybe I shouldn't have been, that your talk about Fort Lewis, what's the term now, JBLM, the former Fort Lewis property, which is huge, that they're very cooperative with this, and you can burn more often there because they're less bureaucratic loops to go through in order to get the permits to burn and so on, and perhaps because of the artillery firing. But you spoke very, very highly of their prairies and their work with you.
Yeah, JBLM, Joint Base Lewis-McChord, they're an extremely cooperative organization. The Department of Defense, though, just like the U.S. Forest Service or the Bureau of Land Management or even the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, it's a federal agency. So they do need to comply with the laws of the Endangered Species Act, just like any other federal agency. And so they understand that, and they're not fighting it. They're complying really well. They're working with us very cooperatively. They provide tremendous amounts of funding between Department of Defense and the funding from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Natural Resource Conservation Service, some of the other federal agencies. We spend millions of dollars every year on prairie conservation to try to improve the conditions of the habitat and to make it a better place for some of these endangered species to live.
Right. Great. Well, one thing that everybody sort of perked their ears up about at your talk was the breeding program in the women's prison and in the zoos for actually breeding some of the endangered butterflies and then releasing them to these prairies you've worked so hard on. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about that breeding program.
Okay, well, Kate, I want to start right off the bat by saying it's not a breeding program.
Oh.
It is a rearing program.
Okay, tell me the difference.
We bring in wild collected animals from the field, and we rear them. But each year we bring in new animals to rear. So whereas a breeding program would mean that those animals are just living and we're just continuing to take new reproduction from them on an annual basis. So
important
it's a little
distinction.
Bit different than breeding, but it's a very strong distinction between the two. So we do a captive rearing program where we're bringing in either larvae or bringing in adults. These would be females that would have eggs in them, and use the eggs and go through basically a life cycle of growing out larvae, and that's the form of the insect that we actually take back out to the field are the larvae. So they're being watched very carefully as they metamorphose, going from one life stage to the next. As they do that, they're being watched very carefully, both by the Oregon Zoo, who does some captive rearing for us, and then the Women's Correctional Center there in Belfair, Mission Creek Correctional Center, actually. And they, between the two of them, they produce about 7,000 larvae per year that we take from them in February, and we take them individually and put them onto the larval host plants that when they wake up, they're going to have food right there at their mandibles, and they're going to be able to eat them right away when they wake up.
Fabulous. Now, what species are you captively rearing?
Well, the one we're doing the most work with right now is the Taylor's Checkerspot butterfly, although the Oregon Zoo is also doing some captive rearing for the Oregon Silverspot butterfly, which is the coastal federally threatened butterfly.
Okay. Well, that sounds fascinating. Well, that's all the time we have, and I appreciate you taking the time to do this with such a hectic schedule.
You're quite welcome, Kate. Hey, it was really nice talking to you.
There are some great upcoming natural history events to tell you about this week.
Join the Olympic Peninsula chapter of the Audubon Society for an evening lecture up at the Dungeness River Audubon Center just outside of Squim, part of their Learn by the Light of the Moon series. This month's talk is titled Behind the Scenes at the Burke Museum, Recent and Ongoing Bird Studies, presented by John Klicka from the Burke Museum at the University of Washington. The event is free and will take place from 7 to 8 p.m. on Thursday, August 15th, under the full moon in their new outdoor amphitheater. For more information, please go to the Olympic Peninsula Audubon.org.
On Saturday, August 17th, join Admiralty Audubon, our Port Townsend Audubon Society chapter, for part two of a three-part series of walks exploring the bird life along the new Chetsamoka Trail. This hike will meet at the Kaitai Lagoon parking area at 8:30 a.m. and head up towards the golf course prairie. Go to admiraltyaudubon.org for details.
Then on Tuesday, August 20th, join the Natural History Society for an all-day tour of the Tarbu Watershed with Peter Bales, biologist and director of the Northwest Watershed Institute. Go to jltnatural@saveland.org to get more information and to RSVP.
And here's our mystery sound again. It's a sooty grouse, and if you don't recognize that name, it's because when you first learned it, as I did, it went by the name of blue grouse. In 2006, the American Ornithologists Union split the species in two, dusky grouse and sooty grouse. The two new species are the same size and resemble one another closely. In Washington, separating them can be challenging in the zone where their ranges meet on the east slope of the North Cascades. But luckily, we don't have to worry about that here on the Olympic Peninsula. We do have another species of grouse in our area, the ruffed grouse, but they are slightly smaller and generally occur at lower elevations than the sooty, with the males having a tail with a black band at the tip, and they sound like a small generator starting up when they drum during the breeding season. The sound that we've played for you is the territorial series hoot of the sooty grouse, one of the most common soundtracks of hiking in our coniferous forests in the late spring and early summer. It is sometimes difficult to pin down the caller, as the males often perch high in the treetops, and the sound can be heard up to a half a mile away. But track them down if you can, or watch for them doing their territorial display in open areas, sometimes in the middle of the road. It's an amazing sight to watch them hoot, with the neck sacs inflated and showing bright yellow, and the tail fanned wide as a peacock's, showing the gray terminal band against a black field. And that's it for KPTC's Nature Now for the second week of August. Thanks so much for joining me, Nora, and thanks to all of you for listening. Closing music is Dog and Butterfly by Heart. As always, happy trails.
No possibilities of getting what I need. He looked at me and smiled.
said, no, 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 child. See the dog and butterfly up in the air, we like to fly. Dog and butterfly, below she had to try. She rode.